Christianity is not a religion founded primarily on philosophical truths. Primarily, Christianity is founded upon historical events, things that happened in history. I mean, just as surely as yesterday things happened to you in your daily life, so there were events that formed the foundation for Christianity. Now, if you want a good example of this, turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 1. This would be one that, I hate to say it, in the series that we're going to embark on in weeks ahead, and who knows how long it's going to take. But this is one of the few times we're going to be in the Bible. I mean, most of the time we're going to be spent talking about history. Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Luke writes, and he says, "Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which are most surely believed among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed." Now, isn't this important to notice here? Luke is saying, first of all, I'm setting in order a narrative. I'm going to tell the story from beginning to end. And what's the story founded on? The testimony of eyewitnesses. In other words, Luke went out and he interviewed people who were eyewitnesses to these things. By the way, Luke was not an eyewitness of these things. Luke did not live in Jerusalem. He did not live in Judea. He didn't grow up there. He was a Gentile. But he could go and talk to the people who were eyewitnesses. And then he says that he's giving an orderly account that people may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed. You see, what we have in the Bible, it isn't fairy tales. It isn't once upon a time. And there's been a lot of people in the last several hundred years who've come forth and tried to act like, well, what's really important about Christianity is, you know, what's really important is the golden rule. You know, that's what it all comes down to. The golden, do unto others, love one another. That's what's really important about Christianity. Now, is the golden rule important? Absolutely it is. Is loving one another important? Absolutely it is. But friends, this is not what Christianity is all about. Anybody can give you this. But only Jesus Christ could come and live and walk this earth as a man and die for our sins on a cross. What a lot of people have wanted to do, excuse me, is to wipe all of that away and act as if it's not important. What's just important is the ethical teaching of Christianity. But we need to have it firmly implanted in our minds that what's important about Christianity is not merely its ethical teaching telling us how to live. What's important are the historical events connected to all of that. Now, it's important for us to understand as well that because these things are historical, that the existence and the ministry of Jesus of Nazareth is confirmed by secular historians in ancient times. Right? Now, how would you want to know? Let's say, you know, you wanted to know who won the Dodger game last Saturday. How would you find out? Well, you'd go and you'd look for research. You'd look in newspapers. You'd try to find accounts that corroborate the game, statistics. Maybe you'd roll footage from the game on television or tapes from the radio. You'd look for things that talk about the event after it happening. And, you know, you go to a sports column and says, well, I was at the game Saturday, June, whatever it was, and I saw this and this and this happening. You go, well, you see, there really was a game. It was there because somebody at the time or close to the time documented it. It would be just the same as, you know, let's say you have a game like, you know, a famous baseball game 50 years ago. And a sports writer of today saying, let's say there was no newspaper record or no record of that game, except right now you have a sports writer who says, well, you know what? 50 years ago, I was at this ball game and this is what happened. Now, would that be enough to say that that game really happened? Maybe, maybe not. It's just the testimony of one man, right? But if there were two or three or four others that say, you know, this game never appeared in the newspapers, but I saw it too, that would be enough. Even though it's 50 years after the fact, their testimony is still reliable. Well, it's the same way when we're talking about who Jesus is from a secular standpoint. What's the word secular mean? Well, basically, in this context, we're taking it to mean non-religious. You see, a lot of people, when they read the Gospels, they say, this isn't true historically. These people are trying to make a point. They're trying to sell you on a position. It's like you go and, you know, you want to buy a car. And you go to the used car salesman or the car salesman. You say, well, is your car the best? Oh, yeah, my car's the best. And he goes on and on. And well, how do you know if he's really being honest? He has a vested interest in lying to you, doesn't he? Well, a lot of people feel the same way about the documents in the New Testament. The gospel writers, well, they have a vested interest in lying to you. You can't really rely on them. But friends, that's nonsense. We can rely on them, and the essential facts of the life of Jesus Christ are confirmed by secular historians, people who have no agreement with Christianity. For example, there was an ancient historian named, and I'm trying to go back as far as I can, ancient historian named Thallus, who wrote in 52 AD. Okay, this is just some 20 years after the ascension of Jesus to heaven. In his history, he mentioned Jesus, and he mentioned the historical events in the Gospels. Now, you say, oh, great, let's just open up Thallus and his work and read it. Problem is, you can't. His work is lost to history. But it was quoted by later writers, such as a guy named Christian Julius Africanus. He wrote in 221 A.D. So we don't have this guy's work, but we have this guy's work, and he quotes him. Matter of fact, one very interesting thing. This fellow, Thallus, this Roman historian, he mentions specifically the darkness that came upon the whole world, or the whole region at least, when Jesus died. He confirms that that really happened. And so this is very interesting that this Roman historian Thallus confirms these things. Again, we don't have his document right in front of us, but he's quoted by later writers. Now, you might say, well, you don't have the original document. Well, there's other people that we do have the original document. There's a fella, and I think I've quoted him, I've included him on your handout there, named Mara Bar Sepion. This fella was writing a letter to his son. And this is somewhere along the terms of 73 AD. And listen how he's writing to. Now, again, this guy is not a historian. He's just a regular guy writing a letter to his son. But notice how matter-of-factly he mentions Jesus. He says, what advantage did the Athenians gain from putting Socrates to death? Famine and plague came upon them as a judgment for the crime. What advantage did the men of Samos gain from burning Pythagoras? In a moment, their land was covered with sand. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? It was just after that their kingdom was abolished. God justly avenged these three wise men. The Athenians died of hunger. The Samanians were overwhelmed by the sea. The Jews, ruined and driven from their land, live in complete dispersion. But Socrates did not die for good. He lived on the teaching of Plato. Pythagoras did not die for good. He lived on in the statutes of Hera. Nor did the wise king die for good. He lived on in the teaching which he had given. Now, this is very interesting, right? This shows you how universal the knowledge of Jesus was in a very short time after his death. Because this is just a normal guy teaching his son lessons. Well, you've got Socrates, you've got Plato, and you've got Jesus. He knew that they were all people who really lived. And of Jesus, he says that he was put to death, executed, and that he was a teacher. Well, these are remarkable things to confirm the gospel record. Then you have the Jewish historian Josephus. Many of you may have heard of the Jewish historian Josephus. He wrote about the year 93. A very interesting character historically. But he writes about Jesus very clearly as a historical person. Again, I believe this is on your handouts. He says here, "Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day." Now, what's very interesting about this quotation from Josephus is this pretty much nails it, right? Here you have a guy who's not a Christian. He's a Jew, and he's a secular Jew at that. Josephus was a man who was aligned with the Roman government. He wasn't loyal and sympathetic to the Jews, though at one time he was, but he went over to the other side and became a stoolie, if you will, for the Romans. But he wrote in his history, and I mean, he so specifically mentions Jesus and this, that a lot of people have looked at this and said, you know what, this can't be legit. Probably a Christian came in later and doctored up Josephus' writing because he's too specific here. He's too on the mark. But you know what? Origen cites Josephus in the year 250 AD, and Eusebius quotes Josephus in the year 324 AD, and both of them cite this quotation in this form exactly. Exactly. And so this is pretty early evidence that this quotation from Josephus is legit and it should stand the way it is. Going down, there was another guy. His name was Lucian. He was a Roman comedian who wrote about Christians in the second century. He says this about Jesus. "Jesus was the man who was crucified in Palestine because he introduced this new cult into the world. Furthermore, their first lawgiver persuaded them that they were all brothers of one another after they had transgressed once for all by denying the Greek gods and worshiping that crucified sophist himself and living under his laws." And you see how critical he is of Christianity and of Jesus. He calls Jesus that crucified sophist. A sophist is a person who uses fancy words and eloquent speaking. And he says, well, Jesus is just some crucified, speech maker. Well, he's critical, but he confirms that Jesus lived and he died and he taught and he was crucified. Here's another one. The Jewish rabbinical writings after the destruction of Jerusalem, this is known as the Mishnah, they several times mention Jesus as a historical figure. This is from the Talmud, quote, "On the eve of Passover, Yeshua was hanged. For 40 days before the execution took place, a herald went forth and cried, 'He's going to be stoned because he's practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Anyone who can say anything in his favor, let him come forward and plead on his behalf.' But since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of the Passover." Well, that's a pretty remarkable historical corroboration. The time, the date, what happened to Jesus, the fact that he was hanged, not from a tree, but on a cross, and all these things, very remarkable historical confirmation. That's why later on, about the year 150 AD, Justin Martyr makes reference to documents which he believed to be in the archives at Rome. He believed that Pilate's report back to the emperor regarding Jesus was contained in the Roman archives. This is what he says, Justin Martyr, in his apology, quoting. He says, "They pierced my hands and my feet are a description of the nails that were fixed in his hands and his feet on the cross. And after he was crucified, those who crucified him cast lots for his garments and divided them among themselves. And that these things were so, you may learn from the acts which were recorded under Pontius Pilate. That he performed these miracles, you may easily be satisfied from the acts of Pontius Pilate." Again, over and over again, we have this historical confirmation of Jesus. The only reason why I belabor this point is that there are still with us today some people who like to go around and act as if Jesus was like a fairy tale. Jesus was a phantom. Or the Jesus that's represented to us in the Gospels, well, he's not the real Jesus. He's not the historical Jesus. We can figure out the real Jesus, and it's just a bunch of garbage. You want to know the real Jesus? Read the Bible. They're historically accurate documents. The historical scholar F.F. Bruce writes this. He says, quote, "Some writers may toy with the fancy of a Christ myth, but they do so not on the grounds of historical evidence. The historicity of Christ is as automatic for an unbiased historian as the historicity of Julius Caesar. It is not historians who propagate the Christ myth theories." Well, it's not just the life of Jesus that we know from history, but it's also the book of Acts. Years and years ago, we're talking a couple centuries ago, people used to regard the book of Acts as kind of like a docudrama, kind of a romance novel of the early church. Not really grounded in history, just kind of, you know, well, let's make up some wonderful stories about how Christianity spread. One of the most remarkable stories regarding this, though, is a guy named William Ramsey. He was a noted archaeologist and Bible scholar, but he himself wasn't a Christian. And he said, "I'm going to go out and prove that Acts is unhistorical." And so he checked names and places and dates and did original archaeological research and retraced the journeys of Paul and over again. And he came up and he said, "You know what? Not only is this thing true, I can tell you that it's the work of contemporary eyewitnesses. The people who were there and saw these events were the people who were the sources for these documents." This is what one fellow, his name is A.N. Sherwin White. He's an expert in Greco-Roman history from Oxford. He writes this about the book of Acts. He says, "The historical framework is exact. In terms of time and place, the details are precise and correct. As documents, these narratives belong to the same historical series as the record of provincial and imperial trials in epigraphical and literary sources of the first and early second centuries A.D. For Acts, the confirmation of historicity is overwhelming. Any attempt to reject its basic historicity, even of matters of detail, must now appear absurd. Roman historians have long taken it for granted." So this is what I want you to know. History is very important to God. He preserved an accurate, well-done historical record, both in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, because again, history is important to God. He wants us to understand it, and he wants us to know something about it. Now, so we're talking about the course of church history, and this morning, what we want to talk about mostly, after laying this sort of historical groundwork, is what we will call the apostolic church. Apostolic, of course, means having to do with the apostles, right? This is the church that we might say was from the year 30 to the year 100 AD. What happened in the year 30? Again, approximately. We're not trying to split hairs with exact dates. Approximately in the year 30, what happened? The church started. Day of Pentecost, okay? This is the beginning of the church. What happened notably around the year 100? Again, so many of the dates that we're going to be using in and throughout this are approximate dates, especially when we're defining eras. Year 100, death of the Apostle John. Now, in one of the handouts I gave you, I'm not really going to talk about that, but I just thought you might be curious to see what some of the historical traditions or biblical evidence is regarding the fate of the 12 apostles. You can look that up. Again, some of that is just based on tradition. It's not based on the Bible, but, you know, it's interesting to look at. So what we have is we're talking about the church during the time of the apostles. Now, one of the most important characteristics of the church during this time was the presence of the apostles. Are there apostles today? This is a great question. Are there apostles in the church today? The answer is yes and no. What does the word apostle mean? Now, this is a very important thing to understand. The word apostle, do you want to know what the Greek word is for apostle? apostolos. In other words, the word we use for apostle, it's not a translation of the Greek apostolos. It's just a carrying it over. In other words, you might say in French, you know, c'est la vie, which means that's life, you know, that's how life is. Well, you're not translating the French, you're just bringing it over, all right? Now, the same thing is, apostle doesn't translate apostolos, it just brings it into English. If you were going to translate the word apostolos, the Greek word apostolos, how might you translate it? Well, probably the best one-word translation is ambassador. An apostolos was somebody who was sent on a specific mission with a specific message to do something on behalf of somebody else. Now, we say in a broad way there are apostles in the church today. I believe very strongly that God has special ambassadors in the church today. People that He raises up to lead not merely churches, but perhaps to lead movements, to be special ambassadors in the church. But there is what you might call the phenomenon of a special ambassador. Let's say apostle with a capital A. In that sense, there are no longer apostles because God had a unique place for those first century apostles that is not replicated in future generations. How do we know that? How many foundations are there to the New Jerusalem? 12. And what's written on the names of those foundations? The names of the 12 apostles. Well, that means that those apostles have a unique place in God's redemptive work. Jesus promised the apostles that they would sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. How many thrones are there? 12. Not, you know, 112. Not for an unlimited number. In other words, there aren't still being made apostles in the same way that the original apostles were. There was something unique about those apostles. And what was it that was unique about them? What was it that was unique? You'll find in Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20. Having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone. In other words, we have a foundation, right? The foundation is the testimony of the apostles and the prophets. Well, once you have that foundation, do you need another foundation? No. We don't build foundation upon foundation. We have the foundation from the apostles and prophets. In other words, there are no more, and this might be the best way to talk about it, there are no more foundational apostles and prophets. There's only one generation of those, period. The apostles had a unique authority, a unique empowering, and their essential teaching, the teaching and the foundation of the apostles and the prophets is preserved for us where? In the New Testament. We don't have to wonder about the foundation. We don't have to feel like we have missed something by not being in the generation of the apostles. Not at all. God has made sure that we have that foundation, and that's in the New Testament. We haven't missed a thing. God laid the foundation. He preserved it for all generations. Now that foundation does not need to be continually being set down and established because it's already been set down. So, the authoritative presence of the apostles and prophets, that was one important characteristic. Okay? What's the second important characteristic of this apostolic church? Well, I would say church life that was both glorious and not so glorious. We run into two very difficult extremes when we talk about the history of the early church, the apostolic church. Some people want to act like the early church was oh man, look at all the problems they had. Look at that. And you know, you can't make the early church your model. Look at all the problems they had. You know, don't pattern your church after the early. Look at all the problems. Then you have other people who say, oh, the early church, it was just heaven on earth. Wow, you know, that's what we have to get back to. And this, well, what's the truth? The truth is somewhere in the middle. There was a glorious work of God going on in the early church. No doubt about it. At the same time, there were definitely problems. I mean, when Paul wrote to the Romans and he said, I praise God, this is Romans 1:8, that your faith is spoken of all over the world. When Jesus speaks to the churches in the book of Revelation, and he speaks to the church of Philadelphia and praises them and talks about their courage and all that God's, you just say, man, this is high living. I mean, is there any church today that measures up to where the church of Philadelphia was? It's like amazing. Oh, this is great. So was the church in the early church at a high level? Yes. But did they also have problems? Absolutely. You go to the book of 1 and 2 Corinthians. Do you see that the early church had some problems? You better believe it. The letters to the churches in the book of Revelation, a lot of those churches had significant problems. Sometimes the problems were moral. Sometimes the problems were doctrinal. In Galatians chapter 1, Paul writes to the Galatians and he says, I am so surprised that you have so soon departed from the gospel that I presented to you. And this is in the apostolic church. So we shouldn't over-romanticize the apostolic church, but neither should we say, well, they don't provide a pattern for us, they don't provide a model. They certainly do provide a pattern and a model, and some of the pattern, some of the model is how you deal with imperfection and sin in the church. And that's how the whole picture comes together. So we shouldn't, we need to keep this balanced view of what the apostolic church was about. Now, a third characteristic of the apostolic church was the spread of the gospel. You know, when you consider what was done in the first generation after Jesus Christ, how the gospel spread without cars or trucks or airplanes, they had ships, without telephones or fax machines or the internet or computers, without cassette tapes or any of those things, without any of those things, how the gospel spread, it's really incredible. And this is one of the huge stories of the early church, of the apostolic church. How the gospel goes all the way from Jerusalem, all the way over to now, it's on the mainland of Italy, having crossed over into the European continent and going all this distance. And this is in a relatively short period of time. You're talking 30, 40 years. The gospel spread this radically. And I'm not just talking about an occasional church here and there. There were a lot of churches and a lot of Christians. All the way to where you could say that in the year 150 AD, a Christian wrote this to the Roman emperor about the growth of Christianity. We've only been around since yesterday, but we've filled everything that belongs to you. The cities, the fortresses, the free towns, the very camps, the palaces, the senate, the forum. The only thing we leave to you is your pagan temples. You can have those. Everything else, the Christians are going to fill up. Now, to what do we attribute this radical growth? Well, I think there was a few things. First of all, the Christians, pretty much, although, you know, we could talk about some of the departures from these things, but pretty much the Christians did a good job of staying on message, preaching the gospel. Now again, there were some departures from this very early on, but overall they did a good job of staying on message. The other thing was they lived right lives. You know, one of the things that early Christian writers used to say is they used to say to their pagan accusers, you want to see that Christianity is true? You want evidence? Look at the way we live. Look at our lives, and you'll see that it's true. Man, most Christians are so busy today saying, you know, don't look at me, look at Jesus, which in the bigger picture is true, isn't it? I mean, that is true. But it's kind of embarrassing that we don't live Christian lives, that we can't at least say with Paul, follow me as I follow Jesus Christ. That's what we should all be able to say. And they really could say it in the early church. So, that's our third characteristic here. The first one was the authoritative presence of the apostles and prophets. The second characteristic was church life that was glorious and not so glorious. The third one was the spreading gospel. Now, here's a fourth one. This apostolic period was an important period of transition. And the transition was from Christianity being a branch of Judaism to being its own faith. Now, you should know that there were a lot of religions in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire sponsored a lot of, here you have the ancient world here. This is the Roman Empire. What you see right here is the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire basically surrounded the Mediterranean Sea as a lake. And this was the Roman Empire, okay? Well, you have all these different people groups all over here, and they're very ethnically and culturally and historically different. Well, they all have their own gods. They all have their own religions. There were a lot of different religions in the Roman Empire of the first century. So in the midst of all these different religions, in the midst of all these different things, the Roman Empire reserved the right to declare some religions legal and some religions illegal. If you like the Latin phrase, it was religio licita or religio illicita. A religion was either licit, which means allowed, or illicit, which means not allowed. Okay? And again, put yourself in the mind of a Roman ruler. This makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, if Bud over here wants to start a religion the basic tenet of faith of my religion is that we need to assassinate the Roman emperor. You know, and he starts amassing followers after himself, the Roman government's going to say, not a chance. This is not happening. You are not going to have a religion that makes this as its tenet. We're going to declare your faith religio illicita, and we're going to try to stamp it out. So the Roman government said, we reserve the rights to give any religion either the stamp of approval or disapproval. Now, Judaism, was it religio licita or illicita? Was it allowed or unallowed in the Roman Empire? Allowed. Often hated, often despised, often that. But I think the bottom line was there were just so many Jews that it was just too problematic for the Roman Empire to declare Judaism religio illicita. So they declared it an allowed religion. Judaism was allowed. Now, when Christianity first started, it was regarded just as a branch of Judaism, right? That's how the Romans saw it. If you were Roman, wouldn't you see it that way? Well, this is just a subgroup of Judaism. So Christianity was carried on the coattails of Judaism. But you notice something, and you'll notice this in the book of Acts. Who are the Christians persecuted by in the book of Acts? Are they persecuted by Romans? No, who are they persecuted by? By the Jews. The Jews distance themselves from Christianity, and Christians distance themselves from Jews. So as time goes on during the period of the apostolic church, it's not very long until Christianity is defined as its own faith. We're not Jewish, we're Christians. Now, when Christianity had its own status before the Roman Empire, was it declared religio licita or illicita? Illicita. It was declared an illicit religion. You say, well, what's the difference? There is a huge difference. Let me put it to you this way. When Christianity was a licit religion, when it was an allowed religion, this is all the time in the book of Acts, right? The enemies of Christianity were unofficial enemies. Who is persecuting Christians in the book of Acts? Jewish religious leaders and angry mobs. Okay? Sometimes you have Gentiles persecuting Christians, but remember, like the silversmiths in Ephesus, it's all out of financial reasons. It's not official. It's an angry mob. Okay? The persecution of Christians in the book of Acts is unofficial. Most of the time, it's the Roman officials who are saving Paul. Not arresting him, they're saving him. All right? Now, when Christianity went out on its own and was declared to be an illicit religion, then the persecution of Christians became official. And let me tell you, there's a pretty substantial difference between scattered, unofficial persecution and state-sponsored persecution. Now, might I say that I believe, and I'm sure you do too, that every Christian should be facing some kind of unofficial persecution in their life. If you're not facing unofficial persecution somewhere down the line, and I mean, maybe it's as simple as a dirty look because you mentioned Jesus, you know, among a group of people, or somebody, you know, sticks out their tongue at you on the freeway because you have a Christian. I mean, even if it's simple, somewhere along the line, you should be facing unofficial persecution as a Christian. There should be some people that you encounter from time to time that are offended at the fact that you have a real relationship with Jesus Christ, because Jesus said that's how it would be. The Bible says that all who are godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. But it doesn't mean that it'll happen in an official, might I say, official translating into state-sponsored. When persecution is unofficial, and when it's real, not just social, but I mean it inflicts real damage upon you. Let's say that somebody beats you up for being a Christian, right? Well, then you can go to the police and say, man, that's assault and battery. They beat me up. Well, why do they beat you up? Because you're a Christian. Well, that's assault and battery. We'll arrest the guy and put him in jail, right? Then the government is on your side, or at least it's supposed to be. But when persecution is sponsored by the state, who do you turn to? Nobody. You see the real different dynamic of fear? Now, let me put it to you this way too. There's state-sponsored persecution that's official and unofficial. For example, in some Muslim countries today, there is very active persecution of Christians by the government. But in other Muslim countries, it's not like there's active persecution against Christians. It's just that if you go and beat up the Christian, and then the Christian goes to the police will say, so what? So in a way, you're being persecuted officially by the state because they won't back you up, but they're not the one beating you up. Well, this transition was made. It began in a big way. This big transition between licit and illicit happened in 64 AD. And what happened in 64 AD? In fact, we can give you a date for it, July 19th, 64 AD. A fire broke out in the working class neighborhoods of Rome. For 7 days, the fire raged, and it destroyed block after block, region after region of crowded tenement housing in Rome. Legend has it that the emperor at the time, Caesar Nero, that Nero fiddled while Rome burned. You know, he was out playing his violin or whatever. And many people in his own day wrote about this and said, we think Nero set this fire. A lot of modern historians think that Nero set the fire because it was his, you know, brutal attempt at urban renewal. He wanted to wipe out the slums and expand his palaces and his own buildings because that's what he did. After the areas were burnt to the ground, he came in, took the land, and built up more palaces to himself in the area. But anyway, the bottom line was this. Whether Nero set the fires or not, he blamed them on the Christians. And Nero, therefore, promised to hunt down and kill Christians. Now notice what the Roman historian Cornelius Tacitus says about this. Now, Tacitus writes several years after this happened, but he's writing on eyewitness accounts. And this is what he says. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Okay, remember, this is still apostolic Christianity. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. It's like Rome was the Los Angeles of its day. Accordingly, an arrest was made first of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, and in Rome, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much on the charge of arson as because of their hatred of the human race. Besides being put to death, they were made to serve as objects of amusement. They were clad in hides of beasts and torn to pieces by dogs. Others were crucified. Others were set on fire to illuminate the night when daylight failed. Literally, what Nero would do was coat living Christians in tar and burn them to death as torches in his gardens. The guy was sick. The guy was depraved. He would take skins of animals, you know, like a cowhide, and sew up a person in it, and then just throw it in the Colosseum and let dogs and bears tear it to pieces and devour the person. This was all done for entertainment. I mean, this is when Christianity started being persecuted by the state. And by the way, according to fairly reliable tradition, both Peter and Paul lost their lives in Nero's persecution of 64 AD, both in Rome. Paul was beheaded, Peter was crucified. Why wasn't Paul crucified? That's right, you couldn't crucify a Roman citizen. He got the merciful execution, the beheading. Now, I want you to notice what Tacitus says about Christians. Isn't this interesting? They believe abominations, that Jesus received the extreme penalty, which would be crucifixion. Isn't that an interesting way to describe? That's very vivid. I mean, that would be a great sermon title, on the cross, the extreme penalty, because that's exactly what it was. He says they believe superstitions that they spread all over the place, starting in Judea and ending up in Rome, and that they had a hatred of the human race. What was it in Christians that caused people to say these things about them? Why would anybody say that Christians practice abominations or believe superstitions or were haters of the human race? First of all, on the one hand, it was an open group. Christians were despised because they were open. They would take anybody. You might go to a Christian meeting and have a slave and a master sitting next together in church. Can you believe it? And then you know what? The slave might be an elder in the church and have authority in the church over the master. That really offended Romans. They thought that kind of thing was an abomination. It's just not fitting. But here's the other problem. Not only was Christianity too open, but it was also too closed. In that they said, not everything's right. They looked at people and they said, you know what? The way you're living's wrong, and it's going to take you to hell. Christianity was a religion that said, some things are right and some things are wrong. And because it said some things were wrong, they were regarded as haters of the human race. Most of the religions of the Roman Empire were polytheistic religions. They believed in a bunch of gods. So you might say, who cares about adding another one? You want to worship Zeus? You want to worship Apollos? You want to worship Mithra? You want to worship Jesus? Who cares? No, but the one God that you couldn't worship is the one that says, there are no other gods. I am the only God. That was the one unacceptable God to the Romans. And so, this is why they say abominations, superstitions, hatred. They hate us. Why? Because they say we're wrong. But it's just important for you to realize that it's not like Christians went around hating people, but it's just because they made a stand that they were accused of hatred. And you know, it's funny. Isn't it exactly the same way today? Exactly. In our world today, you know, you can worship any god you want, except the God that says I'm the only God. Superstitions, they said, you know what they do? They get together in their meetings, and you know what they do? They eat each other's flesh and blood. They practice cannibalism. Yeah. Where would people get that idea? From communion. This is my body. You know, they would. You can see some uninformed person coming into a meeting and somebody just reading from the words of Jesus. And Jesus said, this is my body and this is my blood. And then they pass around stuff to eat. And, good heavens! These kind of distortions and half-truths. Again, I don't want to get too much into it because we'll deal more with it later when we talk about the second phase. But all of this kind of persecution, this era of persecution began in the days of the Apostolic Church. Next week, we'll start talking about not the apostolic church, but what we'll call the early church.